were already living west of the mountains. Americans were eager to fill up the land between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River. They wanted to cut forests, plant cotton and grain, and build roads, cities, and canals. In time, they came to think that their nation should reach all the way across North America to the Pacific Ocean. The Indians stood in the way of these plans, so the United States government came up with the idea of Indian removal, to clear the land so that whites could use it. This removal cost a great deal in lives and suffering. It is hard for historians to measure this huge loss. Chapter 7. As long as grass grows or water runs. From Indian fighter to president. After the Revolution, rich Americans bought up huge pieces of land on the frontier. They planned to sell it later for great profits. This was called speculating. Some of the speculators were founding fathers, including George Washington and Patrick Henry. Another land speculator was also a merchant, slave trader, soldier, and future president. He was Andrew Jackson, the harshest enemy of the Indians in early American history. Jackson became famous during the War of 1812. Textbooks usually say that the war was a struggle against Britain for America's survival. But it was more than that. It was also a war for territory. It allowed the United States to expand into Canada, into Florida, which was owned by Spain, and into Indian territory. Jackson's first Indian wars were against the Creeks, who lived in most of Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. In the midst of the war, Creek warriors massacred 250 whites at an Alabama fort. Jackson's troops took revenge by burning down a Creek village, killing women and children, as well as men. A year later, in 1814, Jackson became a national hero when he fought the Battle of Horseshoe Bend against 1,000 Creeks. He killed 800 of them with few deaths on his side. Jackson owed his victory to Cherokees who fought on his side, because the government had promised to treat them well if they joined the war. Jackson's white troops failed in an attack on the Creeks, but the Cherokees swam a river, came up behind the Creeks, and won the battle for Jackson. When the war ended, Jackson and his friends started buying up Creek lands. Jackson got himself put in charge of treaties. In 1814, he wrote a treaty that took away half the land of the Creek Nation. This treaty started something new and important. The Indians had never thought that land belonged to individual owners. As a Shawnee chieftain named Tecumseh said, "The land belongs to all, for the use of each." But Jackson's treaty gave the Indians individual ownership of land and broke up their shared land holdings. The treaty turned Indian against Indian, bribing some of them with land and leaving others out. Over the next 10 years, Jackson was involved in many more treaties with the Southern Indians. Through force, bribery, and tricks, he helped whites take over 3/4 of Alabama and Florida, 1/3 of Tennessee, and parts of 4 other states. These land grabs became the basis for the Cotton Kingdom of the South, where slaves labored on white-owned plantations. Soon, white settlement reached the edge of Spanish Florida, home of the Seminole Indians and some escaped black slaves. Jackson claimed that the United States had to control Florida in order to defend itself, just what modern nations often say before starting a war of conquest in some other country's territory. Jackson started making raids into Florida, burning Seminole villages and seizing Spanish forts. As a result of these attacks, Spain agreed to sell Florida to the United States. Jackson became governor of the new territory. He also gave his friends and relatives advice on buying slaves and speculating in land. In 1828, Americans elected Jackson president. Under Jackson and Martin Van Buren, the man he chose to follow him as president, the U.S. government removed 70,000 Indians from their homelands east of the Mississippi River. A government official named Lewis Cass explained the removal by saying that savages could not live in contact with a civilized community. Cass had taken millions of acres from the Indians when he was governor of the Michigan Territory. In 1825, at a treaty meeting with the Shawnees and Cherokees, he had promised them that if they moved west across the Mississippi River, the United States will never ask for your land there. The land beyond the river, Cass declared, would remain Indian territory forever. The Terrible Choice. For a few years in the 1820s, before Jackson became president, the southern Indians and whites had settled down. They lived in peace, often close to one another. White men visited Indian communities, and Indians were guests in white homes. Frontier figures like Davy Crockett and Sam Houston came out of this setting. Both of them, unlike Andrew Jackson, were friends of the Indians. Pressure to remove the Indians from the land came from politicians, business interests, land speculators, and population growth that demanded new railroads and cities. These pressures might push poor white frontiersmen into the first violent clashes with the Indians, but the frontiersmen, who were neighbors of the Indians, did not lead the movement to get rid of them. Just how did the government remove the Indians from Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and other places? The answer lies in the difference between federal or national laws and state laws. Federal laws, like treaties between the federal government and the tribes, put the U.S. Congress in charge of Indian affairs, but the states passed their own laws that gave away Indian land to whites. As president, Jackson was supposed to enforce the federal laws. Instead, he ignored them, letting the states do what they wanted. This put the Indians in a terrible position. They would not be forced to go west, but if they stayed, they would have to obey state laws which destroyed their rights. They would suffer endless trouble from whites who wanted their land. On the other hand, if the Indians agreed to leave, the federal government would help them with money and give them land west of the Mississippi. Jackson told the Choctaws and Cherokees that if they left their old lands peacefully, they would be given new lands and the government would leave them alone. He sent them this message. Say to the chiefs and warriors that I am their friend, but they must, by removing from the limits of the states of Mississippi and Alabama, and by being settled on the lands I offer them, put it in my power to be such, there, beyond the limits of any state, in possession of land of their own, which they shall possess as long as grass grows or water runs. I am and will protect them and be their friend and father. Now the pressures began on the tribes one by one. The Choctaws didn't want to leave. But after 50 members of the tribe were bribed with money and land, they signed a treaty that gave up Choctaw lands east of the Mississippi. In return, the Choctaws were supposed to get financial help for the journey west. 13,000 of them began that journey in late 1831, migrating to a land and climate completely different from everything they knew. The army was supposed to organize their trip, but it failed miserably. Indians died by the thousands from hunger, cold, and disease. The 7,000 Choctaws still in Mississippi refused to follow them. Some of their descendants still live in Mississippi. After Jackson was reelected to the presidency in 1832, he speeded up what was called the Indian removal. By this time, Alabama's 22,000 Creeks lived on a tiny portion of their former territory. They agreed to leave in exchange for the federal government's promise that some of that land would be given to individual Creeks who could either sell it or stay on it with federal protection. The government immediately broke its promise. It didn't protect Creeks from whites who swarmed onto their land. An army officer wrote that the Creeks were browbeat and cowed and imposed upon and depressed with the feeling that they have no adequate protection in the United States. Speckled Snake was a man of the Creek Nation. During his long life, he saw the white American government cheat and mistreat the Indians over and over again. When he was more than 100 years old, he told a story about how the white man had betrayed the Indian. "Brothers, I have listened to many talks from our great white father. When he first came over the wide waters, he was but a little man, very little. His legs were cramped by sitting long in his big boat, and he begged for a little land to light his fire on. But when the white man had warmed himself before the Indians' fire and filled himself with their hominy, he became very large. With a step he bestrode the mountains, and his feet covered the plains and the valleys. His hand grasped the eastern and the western sea, and his head rested on the moon. Then he became our great father. He loved his red children, and he said, 'Get a little further, lest I tread on thee.'" After some desperate Creeks attacked white settlers, the government claimed that this war had broken the treaty. Now the U.S. Army could use force to make the Creeks go west. Soldiers invaded Creek communities and marched the people westward in groups of 2,000 or 3,000. The government was supposed to supply things like food, shelter, and blankets to the marchers, but again it failed. Starvation and sickness killed hundreds as the Creeks were carried across the Mississippi on old, rotting boats. More than 300 Indians died when one boat sank. Fighting for Freedom. In December 1835, a government official ordered the Seminoles of Florida to gather at a meeting place to begin their journey west. No one showed up. The Seminoles had decided to fight. They started making surprise attacks on white settlements along the coast, striking quickly from hideouts in the interior. They murdered white families, captured slaves, and destroyed property. General Winfield Scott led U.S. troops into Florida to fight the Seminoles, but they found no one. 2/3 of Scott's officers resigned from the army, worn out by mud, swamps, heat, and disease. The war lasted 8 years and cost $20 million and 1,500 American lives. But the Seminoles were a tiny force fighting a huge nation that had great resources. Finally, in the 1840s, they got tired. The Seminoles asked for a truce, but were arrested. Their leader, Osceola, died in prison, and the war died out. In Georgia, the Cherokees were fighting back in their own way, without violence. They tried to fit into the white man's world by becoming farmers, blacksmiths, and carpenters. They set up a governing council and welcomed Christianity and white missionaries. After their chief, Sequoia, invented a written form of their language, they printed a newspaper in both English and Cherokee. But although the Cherokees were taking up the ways of white society, the whites still wanted their land. Georgia passed laws that stripped the Cherokees of their land and outlawed the tribal government, meetings, and newspaper. Any Indian who encouraged others to stay in the homeland could go to prison. White missionaries who said that the Cherokees should be allowed to remain on their land also received punishments such as 4 years at hard labor in prison. Once again, the federal government arranged a removal treaty with a few Cherokees who signed it behind the backs of most of the tribe. And once again, the government sent the army to enforce the treaty. 17,000 Cherokees were rounded up and crowded into stockades. On October 1, 1838, the first group set out on what came to be called the Trail of Tears. 4,000 Cherokees died of hunger, thirst, sickness, or exposure in the stockades or on the brutal march westward. But in December 1838, President Martin Van Buren told Congress about the entire removal of the Cherokee Nation of Indians to their new homes west of the Mississippi. Congress's decision to remove the Cherokees, Van Buren said, had had the happiest effects. Writing Cherokee. Philip Hoose, in his wonderful book, We Were There Too, argues that it wasn't Cherokee Chief Sequoia alone, but also his six-year-old daughter, Anyoka, who brought a written language to the Cherokee people and found a way to prove its importance to the tribal elders. First, father and daughter tried to make a list of every sound in the spoken language of the Cherokee people and to draw a picture for each sound. Then they made a list of all the spoken syllables. They came up with about 200, but were able to narrow down the list to 86 distinct syllables, each with its own written expression. By now, Anyoka was 10 years old. It was 1821. Sequoia and Anyoka rode to the Cherokee Tribal Council to present their idea. At first, the council laughed because they couldn't see how writing down sayings could be useful in any way. So Sequoia proposed a test. He would leave the room. The tribal council could tell Anyoka anything they wanted, and she would write it down. Then Sequoia would come back, look at the marks on the deerskin, and tell them what they had said. It worked again and again. The first few times, the elders called it luck, Hoose writes. But gradually, doubt gave way to excitement. Soon, thousands of Cherokees wanted to learn how to read. The syllabic alphabet led to the preservation of the Cherokee language, and then to the first American Indian newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix. Before long, school children were learning to read in both Cherokee and English. The letters were called Talking Leaves. Chapter 8. War with Mexico. I have scarcely slept a wink, Ethan Allen Hitchcock wrote in his diary on June 30, 1845. Hitchcock was a colonel in the U.S. Army, stationed in Louisiana. His commander, General Zachary Taylor, had just been ordered to lead his men to the banks of the Rio Grande, a river on the southwest side of Texas. Hitchcock knew that this would bring trouble. "Violence leads to violence," he wrote, "and if this movement of ours does not lead to others and to bloodshed, I am much mistaken." Hitchcock was not mistaken. Taylor's march to the Rio Grande started a bloody war, a war that gave Americans a huge new western territory, taken from a defeated Mexico. Manifest Destiny. Even though Thomas Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase of 1803 had doubled the size of the United States, the country was a lot smaller in 1845 than it is today. Its western border was the Rocky Mountains. To the southwest was Mexico, which had won its independence from Spain in 1821. Mexico was originally much larger than it is now. It included Texas, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, California, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming. Then, with help from the United States, Texas broke away from Mexico in 1836, calling itself the Lone Star Republic. In 1845, the U.S. Congress added Texas to the United States. By that time, many Americans believed that their country should expand or grow larger toward the West. One of these expansionists was President James Polk. He told his secretary that one of his main goals as president was to get California into the United States. A newspaper called the Washington Union supported Polk's idea with these words: "The road to California will be open to us. Who will stay," meaning halt or stop, "the march of our western people?" Soon afterward, in the summer of 1845, another newspaper editor, John O'Sullivan, wrote, "Our manifest destiny is to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions." O'Sullivan was saying that Americans should be free to occupy all of North America because God meant for them to. His words, manifest destiny, a fate or a purpose that was clear to see, became a slogan for expansionists. For a long time, Mexico and the United States had agreed that the border between them was the Nueces River, about 150 miles north of the Rio Grande. But during Texas's fight for independence from Mexico, Texans had captured the Mexican general Santa Anna and forced him to say that the border was the Rio Grande. This made Texas bigger. Afterward, President Polk promised the Texans that he would consider the Rio Grande the border, even though Mexicans still lived in the area between the two rivers. So when Polk ordered General Taylor to move troops to the Rio Grande, he was challenging Mexico. Sending the army into territory inhabited by Mexicans was sure to cause conflict. But when the soldiers reached the Rio Grande, they found empty villages. The local Mexicans had fled across the river to the city of Matamoros. Taylor started building a fort with cannons pointed at Matamoros. By the spring of 1846, the army was ready to start the war that Polk wanted. All it needed was an excuse. Then, one of Taylor's officers disappeared while riding along the river. He was later found with a smashed skull. Everyone figured that Mexican guerrilla fighters had crossed the river and killed him. The very next day, Mexicans attacked a patrol, killing 16 soldiers. Taylor sent a message to Polk that the fighting had begun. The Mexicans had fired the first shot, but they had done what the American government wanted. Colonel Ethan Allen Hitchcock knew that. Even before the attacks, he wrote in his diary, "I have said from the first that the United States are the aggressors. We have not one particle of right to be here. It looks as if the government sent a small force on purpose to bring on a war so as to have a pretext, reason, for taking California and as much of this country as it chooses. My heart is not in this business, but as a military man, I am bound to execute orders." For and against the war. President Polk had been urging Congress to declare war even before he received word of the attacks from General Taylor. As soon as Taylor's messages arrived, Polk told Congress, "Mexico has passed the boundary of the United States, has invaded our territory, and shed American blood upon the American soil." Congress declared war. Only a handful of congressmen voted against it. They were strongly opposed to slavery, and they believed that the war was an excuse to gain territory that would be made into new slave states. Joshua Giddings of Ohio called it an aggressive, unholy, and unjust war. Many Americans cheered the news of war. They held rallies to support it in cities across the land, and they volunteered for the army by the thousands. The poet Walt Whitman wrote proudly in a newspaper that "America knows how to crush as well as how to expand." Another poet, James Russell Lowell, took a different view of the war. He wrote a poem saying that the only reason for it was to lug new slave states in. Massachusetts writer Henry David Thoreau criticized the war. He was also jailed for refusing to pay a poll tax, but he only spent one night there. He was released because his friends paid the tax for him without his permission. 2 years later, Thoreau wrote an essay called Civil Disobedience. It talks about the difference between law and justice, and about how soldiers sometimes know that the orders they are following are wrong. "Law never made men a whit more just, and by means of their respect for it, even the well-disposed are daily made the agents of injustice. A common and natural result of undue respect for law is that you may see a file of soldiers marching in admirable order over hill and dale to the wars, against their wills, aye, against their common sense and consciences, which makes it very steep marching indeed. Many members and leaders of churches spoke out against the war. As the months passed, other voices joined in. Newspaperman Horace Greeley wrote in the New York Tribune that the war was unnecessary. Anti-slavery activist Frederick Douglass, who had once been a slave, called the war disgraceful and cruel. The anti-slavery paper The Liberator went even further, wishing the most triumphant success to the Mexicans. What about ordinary people? It's impossible to know how many of them supported the war, but there is evidence that some workers were against it. Many Irish workers showed up at an anti-war meeting in New York City. They called the war a plot by slave owners. The New England Workingmen's Association also spoke out against the war. The flood of army volunteers slowed down after the first rush of excitement. To get enough soldiers, the army was forced to pay for new recruits. It also offered land to volunteers if they served for the entire war. Some of the men who did enlist were shocked by the bloody horror of war. After a battle outside Matamoros, for example, 50 Americans and 500 Mexicans lay dead or wounded on the field. The screaming and groaning from both sides was terrible to hear. Other new soldiers sickened and died in miserable, unhealthy conditions, such as the crowded ships that carried them to the front. And still others deserted to the Mexican side for better pay. The Conquest of California. A separate war went on in California. Soldiers moved into California by land and sea. One of them was a young naval officer who imagined what would happen when the United States owned this western territory. "Population will flow into the fertile regions of California," he wrote in his diary. Americans in California raided Mexican settlements that had been founded by the Spanish. They stole horses. And they declared the territory independent, calling it the Bear Flag Republic. An American naval officer gathered chiefs from the Indian tribes in California and told them, "The country you inhabit no longer belongs to Mexico, but to a mighty nation whose territory extends from the great ocean you have all seen or heard of, the Pacific, to another great ocean, thousands of miles toward the rising sun, the Atlantic. Our armies are now in Mexico and will soon conquer the whole country. But you have nothing to fear from us if you do what is right, if you are faithful to your new rulers. We shall watch over you and give you true liberty. But beware of sedition, treason, lawlessness, and all other crimes, for the army which shields can assuredly punish, and it will reach you in your most retired hiding places." Meanwhile, American soldiers advanced westward through New Mexico. They captured the city of Santa Fe without a battle. A few months later, though, Mexicans in the nearby city of Taos revolted against American rule. The revolt was stopped, but some of the rebels escaped to the hills. They carried out occasional attacks, killing Americans until the U.S. Army killed 150 of them in a final battle. In Los Angeles, too, there was a revolt. Mexicans forced the American troops to surrender in September 1846. The U.S. military did not recapture Los Angeles until December, after a bloody battle. Victory over Mexico. By this time, General Taylor had moved across the Rio Grande and taken Matamoros. His army was marching southward through Mexico. The men were becoming hard to control. Soldiers got drunk and looted Mexican villages. Cases of rape increased. At the same time, sickness and heat were killing the soldiers. 1,000 of them died on the march. At Monterrey, they fought another battle with the Mexicans. So many men and horses died in agony that one U.S. officer said that the ground was slippery with foam and blood. The U.S. Navy fired shells on the Mexican coastal city of Veracruz, killing many civilians. One shell hit a post office. Another hit a hospital. After 2 days and 1,300 shells, the city surrendered. An American reporter wrote, "The Mexicans variously estimate their losses at from 500 to 1,000 killed and wounded, but all agree that the loss among the soldiery is comparatively small and the destruction among the women and children is very great." General Winfield Scott now moved an army of 10,000 soldiers into the heart of Mexico. A series of battles that had little point killed thousands of people on both sides. Finally, the armies of the two nations met to fight for control of Mexico City. A Mexican merchant wrote to a friend about the American conquest of the city. "In some cases, whole blocks were destroyed, and a great number of men, women, and children killed and wounded." In spite of their victories, the American soldiers were getting tired of marching, fighting, and risking death. Desertions were a problem. In March 1847, the army reported 1,000 deserters. More than 9,000 deserted over the course of the war. In northern Mexico, volunteers from Virginia, Mississippi, and North Carolina rebelled against their commander. He killed one of the mutineers, but two of his lieutenants refused to help him stop the mutiny. The army later forgave the rebellious soldiers in order to keep the peace. The glory of victory was for the president and the generals, not for the deserters, the dead, and the wounded. Many men felt anger toward those who had led them into deadly conditions and battles where so many had died. One group, the Massachusetts Volunteers, had started with 630 men. They came home with 300 dead, mostly from disease. At a celebration dinner on their return, the men hissed at their commander. Some volunteers who made it home ended up with little to show for their soldiering. The government had promised them land, but speculators immediately showed up to buy the land from them. Many of the men, desperate for money, sold their 160 acres for less than $50. When Mexico surrendered, some Americans thought that the United States should take the whole country. Instead, it took just half. In February 1848, Mexico and the United States signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. In the treaty, Mexico gave the entire Southwest and California to the United States. It also agreed that the border between the two nations was the Rio Grande. The United States, in turn, agreed to pay Mexico $15 million. This let people say that the nation's new territories were bought, not seized by force. One American newspaper claimed that, "We take nothing by conquest, thank God." Chapter 9. Slavery and Emancipation. The United States government supported slavery. As the economy of the South grew, so did the number of enslaved people. Between 1790 and 1860, the amount of cotton that the South produced rose from 1,000 tons a year to 1 million tons a year. In that same period, the number of slaves rose from 500,000 to 4 million. Slavery was so well established that only something enormous, something like a full-scale war, could end it. Slavery in the American South. The United States government made it illegal to import new slaves in 1808. Previously, many northern port cities had benefited from the slave trade. From 1808 on, slavery in the U.S. was supposed to be limited to Africans who were already enslaved and their children. But the demand for new slaves was great, so the law was often broken. In his book, From Slavery to Freedom, historian John Hope Franklin estimates that 250,000 slaves were illegally imported before the Civil War began in 1861. How can slavery be described? Maybe only people who have experienced it can say what it was like. People like John Little, a former slave who wrote, "They say that slaves are happy because they laugh and are merry. I myself and 3 or 4 others have received 200 lashes in the day and had our feet in fetters. Yet at night we would sing and dance and make others laugh at the rattling of our chains. Happy men we must have been. We did it to keep down trouble and to keep our hearts from being completely broken. That is as true as the gospel." Desperation drove some slaves to revolt. Probably the largest revolt in the United States took place near New Orleans in 1811. It involved 400 to 500 slaves. The U.S. Army and militia forces attacked them and ended their revolt. In 1822, a free black man named Denmark Vesey tried to launch a revolt in South Carolina, but authorities found out about it and hanged him along with 34 others. Then in Virginia in the summer of 1831, a slave named Nat Turner led about 70 others on a rampage from plantation to plantation. They murdered at least 55 men, women, and children. As their ammunition ran out, they were captured. Turner and others were hanged. Other slaves ran away. Each year during the 1850s, about 1,000 slaves escaped into the North, Canada, and Mexico. One famous escaped slave, Harriet Tubman, made 19 dangerous trips back into slave territory, helping slaves escape on the Underground Railroad. She told them, "You'll be free or die." Whites sometimes helped slaves, and that worried the authorities. Some feared that poor whites would encourage slave revolts, not just because they felt sorry for the slaves, but because they hated the rich planters and wanted to see their property destroyed. Fanny Kemble, a famous actress who married a Southern planter, wrote in her journal that black slaves and white Irish workers were kept apart when they were building a canal in Georgia. "The Irish were a warm-hearted, generous people," she said, "who might actually take to sympathy with the slaves." The Abolition Movement. Some white Americans did take to sympathy with the slaves. They were called abolitionists because they called for the abolition or end of slavery. They bravely wrote newspaper articles and made speeches against slavery. They also helped many slaves escape on the Underground Railroad, a network of people who worked together to conduct runaway slaves to free territory, providing safe houses for them along the way. But black abolitionists were the backbone of the movement against slavery. The North had about 130,000 free blacks in 1830. 20 years later, there were 200,000. Many of them worked to free those who remained enslaved in the South. One of them was David Walker, son of a slave, who sold old clothes in Boston. He wrote a pamphlet called Walker's Appeal, urging blacks to fight for their freedom. "Let our enemies go on with their butcheries and at once fill up their cup. Never make an attempt to gain our freedom or natural right until you can see your way clear. When that hour arrives and you move, be not afraid or dismayed. God has been pleased to give us 2 eyes, 2 hands, 2 feet, and some sense in our heads as well as the whites. They have no more right to hold us in slavery than we have to hold them. Every dog must have its day. The Americans is coming to its end." The appeal made Southern slaveholders so angry that one of them offered a reward for David Walker's murder or capture. One summer day in 1830, Walker was found dead near the doorway of his shop. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery, learned to read and write, and escaped into the North at the age of 21. He became the most famous black man of his time, speaking and writing against slavery. Douglass called The idea of being a free man someday, a dream that all the powers of slavery could not destroy. After the war with Mexico, the U.S. government brought California and other new territories into the Union as non-slave states. In return, the government had to do something for the slave states, so it passed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. This law made it easy for slave owners to recapture runaway slaves even after they had fled to the northern states. It made it easy for slave owners to just pick up free blacks they claimed had run away. Northern abolitionists, black and white, fought against the act. The year after Congress passed the law, a runaway slave named Jerry was captured and put on trial. A crowd broke into the Syracuse, New York courthouse to set him free. On July 4, 1852, Frederick Douglass gave a speech that placed the shame of slavery on the whole nation, not just the South. He said, "Fellow citizens, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. There is not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour." The government of the United States did not strongly enforce the law that ended the slave trade, yet it enforced runaway slave laws. The government under President Andrew Jackson worked with the South to keep abolitionist newspapers from being mailed in southern states. The nation's Supreme Court declared in 1857 that the slave Dred Scott, even though he had lived for some time in free territories, could not sue for his freedom because he was property, not a person. That government would never accept an end to slavery through rebellion. Slavery would end only under conditions controlled by whites and only when it suited the business and political needs of the North. Abraham Lincoln was the perfect figure to bring about the end of slavery. Lincoln understood the needs of business. He shared the political ambition of the new Republican political party. Finally, he spoke the language of doing good, and he could argue with passion against slavery on moral grounds. At the same time, he acted with caution in the world of politics, and he feared that abolition would cause new problems. Although Lincoln believed that slavery was unjust, he could not see blacks as the equals of whites. The best thing to do, he thought, would be to free the slaves and send them back to Africa. The Civil War and Slavery. The Northern elite, the bankers and businessmen who directed the economy of the North, wanted their kind of economy to expand. They wanted free land, free labor, and taxes that favored manufacturers. Lincoln shared their ideas. Southern planters, on the other hand, felt that Lincoln and the Republicans would make their own pleasant, prosperous way of life impossible. So when Lincoln was elected president in the fall of 1860, 7 Southern states seceded or left the Union. When Lincoln tried to take back the federal base at Fort Sumter, North Carolina, by force, 4 more states seceded. The South formed the Confederacy, and the Civil War was on. Abolitionists urged Lincoln to emancipate or free the slaves in the South. But Lincoln made it clear that he had not gone to war to free the slaves. His goal was to bring the South back into the Union. In a letter to abolitionist and newspaperman Horace Greeley, Lincoln wrote, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it." But as the war grew more bitter and the North grew more desperate to win, Lincoln began to act against slavery. In September 1862, he gave the Southern states 4 months to stop fighting, warning that he would free their slaves if they did not come over to the Union side. the fighting continued. On January 1, 1863, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves in areas that were fighting against the Union. 2 years later, before the war ended, Congress passed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which ended all slavery in the United States. These changes affected African Americans in many ways, not all of them good. Once blacks were free to enter the Union Army, the war started to look more like a war for black liberation. The more whites suffered, the more they resented blacks. Angriest of all were poor whites who were drafted into the army. Rich people could buy their way out of the draft for $300. That was a huge amount of money. At that time, the average skilled worker, such as a carpenter, earned about $2 a day. Unskilled workers earned less. Draft riots in 1863 in northern cities turned whites against their black neighbors in a wave of violence and death. And the treatment of black soldiers in the army and the northern cities showed that freedom might not bring acceptance or true equality. Black soldiers were given the dirtiest and hardest work, and when they were off duty, whites sometimes attacked them on the street. The Civil War was one of the bloodiest conflicts in history up to that time. It killed 600,000 people out of a population of 30 million. By late 1864, the South was losing. Soldiers were in short supply, but there were 4 million slaves. When some Confederate leaders spoke of enlisting slaves, one shocked general wrote, "If slaves will make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong." In March 1865, Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, signed a law that let blacks serve in the Army of the South. But before the law had any effect, the war ended. The South had lost, and its slaves learned that they were now free. Emancipation without freedom. Many years after the war, African Americans who had been young children in 1865 recalled the tears, songs, and hope of the slaves who heard the news of their emancipation. It was a time of great celebration, the dawn of a new day. Yet many blacks knew that their status after the war would not depend on a law that made them free. It would depend on whether they owned land or had to work for others. Much land in the South either went back to the families of the Confederates or was bought by northern land speculators and investors. Blacks could not afford to buy much of it. Ex-slave Thomas Hall said, "Lincoln got the praise for freeing us, but did he do it?" Hall felt that Lincoln gave the slaves freedom, but did not give them the chance to support themselves. Freed slaves still had to depend on whites for work and survival. The United States government had fought the slave states not to end slavery, but to keep control of the enormous territory, resources, and market of the South. Still, the end of slavery brought new forces into politics. One force was white people concerned with racial equality. Some of them came south to teach or work for the Freedmen's Bureau that the government set up to aid the freed slaves. A second force was blacks determined to make their freedom mean something. A third force was the Republican Party. It wanted to keep control over the national government, and the votes of southern blacks could help. Northern businessmen felt that Republican plans benefited them, so they went along for a while. These forces created a brief period after the Civil War, when blacks in the South voted, elected blacks to state legislatures and to the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, and introduced free, racially mixed education. New laws protected them from discrimination and guaranteed them equal rights. But because blacks depended on whites for work, their votes could be bought or taken away by the threat of violence. White violence against blacks erupted in the South almost as soon as the war ended. In May 1866, in Memphis, Tennessee, whites killed 46 African Americans and burned more than 100 homes, churches, and schools. The violence continued as white terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan organized raids, beatings, and racial murders called lynchings. The state of Kentucky alone had 116 acts of racial violence between 1867 and 1871. As white violence rose in the 1870s, the national government grew less committed to protecting blacks. Northern politicians started to weigh the advantage of black voters' support against the advantage of a stable South controlled by whites who would accept Republican leadership. It was only a matter of time before blacks would be returned to a condition that was not far from slavery, even if they remained legally free. In 1877, the Republican Party leaders made a deal to get their candidate, Rutherford Hayes, elected president. In return for the necessary electoral votes, they agreed to remove Union troops from the South. This took away the last military protection for Southern blacks. Their legal protection was crumbling, too, as the Southern states passed laws that chipped away at equality. By the end of the 19th century, the U.S. Supreme Court approved laws that allowed segregation or separation of people by race. Only one Supreme Court justice, a former slave owner named John Harlan, argued against segregation, saying, "Our Constitution is colorblind." With its economy in ruins, the South needed money. A new alliance formed between the Northern bankers and investors and the Southern elites. They talked about the new South of coal and iron mines, business and railroads. The former slaves were swept out of the picture. By 1900, all of the Southern states had passed laws that kept African Americans from voting and from enjoying equal rights. At this low point for black people in America, blacks knew that they had been betrayed. Some fled the South, hoping to escape violence and poverty. Those who remained organized for self-defense in the face of more than 100 lynchings a year. Thomas Fortune, a young black editor for the New York Globe, told the Senate, "The white man who shoots a Negro always goes free, while the Negro who steals a hog is sent to the chain gang for 10 years. W.E.B. Du Bois, a black man who came to teach at Atlanta University, saw the betrayal of the African Americans as part of something bigger that was happening in the United States. He said that poor whites and blacks were both being exploited or used by politicians and big business. Because whites could vote, they didn't think they were exploited. Du Bois said, though, that the dictatorship of vast capital limited the power of their votes. He was talking about the economic system called capitalism, in which private individuals or companies, rather than the state, own the farms and factories, set prices and compete with each other in the marketplace, and accumulate wealth. Was Du Bois right? Did the growth of American capitalism mean that whites as well as blacks were, in some sense, becoming slaves? Chapter 10. The Other Civil War. The war between North and South was not the only conflict in the United States during the 19th century. There was another war going on, a struggle between classes. This struggle is often left out of textbooks. Instead, textbooks can make it seem as though the history of the time was a clash between the Republican and Democratic political parties, even though both parties represented the classes that held most of the power in the country. The myth of Jacksonian democracy. Andrew Jackson, who was elected president in 1828, said he spoke for the humble members of society, for workers and farmers. He certainly did not speak for the Indians being pushed off their lands, or for enslaved African Americans. But the government needed a large base of support among white people, and the myth of Jacksonian democracy was designed to win that support. That myth led ordinary people to believe that they had a voice in government, and that government looked out for their interests. It was a way of speaking for the lower and middle classes to get their support when the government needed it. Giving people a choice between two political parties and letting them choose the slightly more democratic one was a good way to control them. The leaders of both parties understood that they could keep control of society by making reforms that gave people some of what they wanted, but not too much. The United States was developing with enormous speed and excitement. It was turning into an urban or city-dwelling nation. In 1790, fewer than 1 million Americans lived in cities. By 1840, the figure was 11 million. New York City alone grew from 130,000 people in 1820 to 1 million in 1860. Many city dwellers lived in extreme poverty. Working-class families in Philadelphia crowded into apartment buildings called tenements, one family to a room, with no fresh water or toilets. In New York, the poor lay in the streets with the garbage. The slums had no sewers. Filthy water drained into them, causing outbreaks of deadly diseases. The very poor could not be counted on to support the government. They were like the slaves and Indians, invisible most of the time, but frightening to the elite if they started an uprising. Other citizens, though, might support the system. Farmers who owned their land, better paid laborers, and urban office workers were paid just enough and flattered just enough that in a crisis they would be loyal to the system and the upper classes that dominated it. Big business. Business was booming in 19th century America. The opening of the West was helped by canals, railroads, and the telegraph. New equipment, such as iron plows and mechanical reapers, made farming more productive. But the economy was not planned or managed to meet human needs. Instead, it was driven by the quest for private profits. It cycled between booms, times of growth and prosperity, and slumps, times of depression and unemployment. To make business more stable and to reduce competition, companies joined together. For example, many railroads merged to form one, the New York Central Line. Companies also controlled competition by agreeing among themselves on the prices they would charge the public for their goods and services. In addition, they got help from the government. During just 7 years in the 1850s, the state and federal governments gave away 25 million acres to railroad companies, along with millions of dollars in loans. On the eve of the Civil War, the men who ran the country were most concerned with money and profit, not the movement against slavery. A preacher named Theodore Parker told his congregation, "Money is this day the strongest power of the nation." But the effort to keep politics and the economy under control did not quite work. From time to time, poor people showed their anger at the crowded cities, long hours in factories operating new industrial machines, high prices, lost jobs, disease, and miserable tenements. In 1827, at a meeting of mechanics, crafts and trade workers, one young man spoke of how hard it was to make a living and of how laborers were at the mercy of their bosses. "We find ourselves oppressed on every hand. We labor hard in producing all the comforts of life for the enjoyment of others, while we ourselves obtain but a scanty portion, and even that in the present state of society depends on the will of employers." Sometimes there were sudden, unorganized uprisings against the rich. Sometimes the anger got turned against blacks, Catholics, or immigrants. Sometimes there were sudden, unorganized uprisings against the rich. Sometimes the anger got turned against blacks, Catholics, or immigrants. And sometimes the poor organize their anger into demonstrations and strikes against the bankers, land speculators, landlords, and merchants who control the economy. Workers unite. In 1829, the working people of Philadelphia held one of the first